Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the matter with girls today? Many seem to be firing on all cylinders, working day and night to earn good grades and exceed at sports and other extracurricular activities. But are they equally strong on the inside? Despite all that high achievement, my guest today points to the growing rates among American girls of depression, anxiety, self-mutilation, and sexual ambivalence as signs that many are, in fact, in serious jeopardy. Dr. Leonard Sachs is a family physician and psychologist. His newest book is called Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls. Leonard, welcome to Think.
Thanks for inviting me.
You write here that girls are suffering from an underdeveloped sense of self. What does that mean, and how does it manifest itself?
Sure. So let's imagine you're sitting and talking with a 5 or 6 or 7-year-old girl or boy, for that matter, and you say to that young girl or boy, you say, tell me about yourself. A 5 or 6 or 7-year-old might reasonably say, well, I love dancing and I hate broccoli. And that's a good answer. That is age appropriate. That's about as much as you're going to get from a 5 or 6-year-old in terms of a genuine and articulate answer. Ask a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old, and you should get something more substantive, something that goes a bit deeper, where a teenager might share with you what they really care about, what they really enjoy doing, what they hope to be. But many therapists and many researchers are finding today when you talk to a 15- or a 16-year-old girl and ask her, tell me about yourself, she will say essentially, I like dancing and I hate broccoli. Or she may say, well, I'm a really good student. I have a 3.92 GPA and I am really good at soccer. And you'll say, well, that's great, you know, that's what you do, but tell me about who you are. And one girl I was speaking to said, well, I just did. You know, what else is there? Well, there is actually a lot more to being a human being than your grade point average and what sports you play. But increasingly, and this is true for affluent white girls, just as it's true for girls of color from low-income neighborhoods. In fact, it seems to be more true for affluent white girls, a bit of a curiosity there. These girls are so focused on the surface, on how they present themselves, that they're not making that connection with who they are.
You have written before about the specific problems of boys. You have another title, Boys Adrift. Is it common, has it always been throughout history, that aside from the things that are definitely driven by differing biology, have boys and girls always had very different sets of problems at this age?
Oh, that's a good question. I have consulted with comparative anthropologists, especially in writing my second book. That is, people who spend their time studying how different cultures have handled the transition to adulthood in different times and different places. And, yeah, I think I'm sure there are exceptions, but I think as a general rule, boys' issues and girls' issues have been quite different. And we kind of thought that we were going to get beyond that, because 50 years ago, boys expected to grow up and be in the trades of the professions. And the general expectation 50 years ago was that girls were going to get married and be mothers and homemakers. Of course, that's the medieval period we're talking about, 50 years ago. So we like to believe now, in our era of equal opportunity, girls have the same opportunities as boys. So I don't think people really expected to see that girls' issues are profoundly different from boys. But they are, and that's an empirical finding. And this came through very clearly in my own practice. I'll tell you, one family where, let's see, this is an older son, younger daughter. Older son not doing well in school. He's on the verge of flunking Spanish. He doesn't care. He's not working anywhere near up to his ability. He spends most of his free time playing video games. Younger daughter doing really well, getting practically straight A's and engaged in all these activities. And the parents, of course, are very concerned about the older son. As his mom said to me, she said, "What worries me about him," she said, "is that he's not worried. He doesn't seem to be concerned about the fact that he's not going to be qualified to go to any decent college. But he doesn't seem to be bothered. But when you sit and talk to the younger daughter, you discover she's waking up at 2 in the morning. She has trouble getting to sleep. She has trouble staying asleep. She wakes up in the middle of the night obsessing about the one piece of pizza that she ate for supper. She's convinced she's fat, even though she's not. She's 13 years old, and she's frantic with concern that her parents won't be able to afford the tuition at the right college that she wants to attend. She's 13 years old, but she's losing sleep worrying about paying for college. And now we just found out she's cutting herself with razor blades on her upper inner thigh, where she didn't think anyone would look. So she has some she's troubled. Her older brother has problems, too, but his problems are really different. Now, this boy and this girl, they have the same parents, the same home, the same resources. And they both have problems, but their problems are really different. And parents need to understand those differences and why the issues for boys today are so different from the issues for girls.
Let's talk about that self-destructive behavior like cutting, particularly among girls who seem to have everything else sort of sewn up in their lives. You have found in your practice that it is becoming more common. First of all...
And that's not merely my practice. That's the work of scholars across the United States. For example, 26 years ago, I was a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania. I was doing a psychiatry rotation, and a teenage girl was admitted to the psychiatric unit inpatient. She'd been cutting herself with razor blades since 1985, and the resident was like, "Wow, that's so weird." And the attending psychiatrist put her in the lock ward on full suicide precautions. He said this was a cry for help and a suicide gesture. It was neither of those things. We now know it's not a cry for help. These girls don't want you to know that they're doing it, as a rule.
Yeah.
And it's not a suicide gesture. They don't want to die. They don't want to take their own lives. But it was so rare 30 years ago, you can't blame the psychiatrist for not understanding it. It is now very, very common. For example, researchers at Yale University School of Medicine went door-to-door. They didn't want girls who'd been referred for anything. They literally went door-to-door in New Haven, knocking on doors to see, among girls 10 to 14 years of age, who's cutting themselves with razor blades. They found more than 30%, more than 3 out of 10, of these girls in a completely random selection were cutting themselves with razor blades or burning themselves with matches. That's a huge increase. It's a factor of 10 increase in less than two decades. Why has this become so common? Lady Gaga, Lindsay Lohan, Angelina Jolie,
Disney Channel, Demi Lovato.
They all want you to know that they have a history of cutting themselves with razor blades. That's really weird.
Well, let's talk about that. For people who have never been compelled to even try something like this, what do girls in your care tell you what is the reason for doing this to themselves?
It relieves the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another big change compared with 40 years ago. You know, I'm old enough to remember a 1966 television program called Gidget, starring Sally Field. Sally Field was not always an older woman marketing medications for osteoporosis. She once was a teenager herself. And one of her big breaks early in her career was to play this lead role in this show, Gidget, about a giggly, carefree teenage girl who had these various harmless adventures. It was enormously popular in that era because in that era there were a lot of giggly, carefree teenage girls, not anymore. Again, this is the scholarly work of Jean Twenge and others that I cite in this regard, not merely my own impressions from my practice. 40 years ago, it was unusual to find girls who had trouble getting to sleep or staying asleep. 40 years ago, it was unusual to find girls who were so anxious they couldn't concentrate or focus. Today, it is common. The anxious, obsessed teenage girl has become the cultural norm. We don't have Gidget anymore. We have Gossip Girl. And Gossip Girl is a show essentially about three young women who are anxious and obsessed and can't sleep at night and have 20 different things going on that they're incredibly concerned about. That's become the new norm because that's the lived experience of many teenage girls and young women today.
You know, it's interesting, Leonard, that a lot of parents, I don't know what this says about the world today, but are somewhat relieved by the popularity of the Twilight books, which, among other things, are a sort of allegory about teens resisting the urge to be sexually active. You point out, though, that in these novels, the girls are girls and the boys are men. Can you talk about that?
It's so weird that these novels are so popular, because when I speak to girls at schools, and I very often, when I go to public schools and private schools, I'll meet with the girls, and I'll say, okay, who's read Twilight? And most of the hands go up. And I'll say, okay, let's talk about Bella, okay? And for the people who haven't read the books and don't know them, I explain that at the beginning of the second book, Edward, her boyfriend, dumps Bella, the starring girl, and her life comes to a halt. The next chapter is entitled October. After she's been dumped, you turn the page. It is a blank page. The next chapter is November. You turn the page. It is a blank page. Without her boyfriend, she has nothing, and she is nobody. Her life revolves completely around her boyfriend, and she only begins to have a life again when Jacob, another boy, takes an interest in her. That is so old-fashioned. In a really profound way, it's old-fashioned, that your life only matters if boys are interested in you. And I contrast that with some of the old Nancy Drew books, like The Secret Staircase, where Nancy, this is more than 60 years ago we're talking now, but the twilight of that era was the Nancy Drew books, which were hugely popular with girls in that era. So in The Secret Staircase, a Nancy Drew book, her father is kidnapped. Nancy has a boyfriend. He's an irrelevant character who does nothing of importance. You barely see him. He's just arm candy, basically. She goes out on her own, identifies the three kidnappers whom the police have not been able to find. She tracks them down. She frees her father. She does everything. In the Twilight books, Bella is a perpetual victim. Again, in book two, she is so lonely for Edward. She climbs up to the top of a cliff and jumps off into the water, not trying to commit suicide, but just thought it would be fun to do. And then when she's in the water, it occurs to her she doesn't really know how to swim, and she's now in the Pacific Ocean, so she's drowning, and she's going to drown until Jacob rescues her. And this happens over and over and over. She's a complete dimwit who consistently puts herself in mortal danger and is rescued by a boy, Edward or Jacob. And this, okay, so fine, so it's a dumb novel. But what's curious is, why do girls love this so much? I mean, this is enormously popular. It is unbelievable how popular this is. And that's what intrigues me about it. Why do girls find this so appealing? And I think one reason is because we have neglected the transition to adulthood. We used to have a community of women that taught girls what it means to be a woman. We used to have a community of men for boys. Then somewhere in the last 20 or 30 years, we decided that doesn't matter. They can figure it out on their own. And besides, gender doesn't matter anyhow. Girls and boys can do whatever they want to be. Well, it does matter. And when you ignore that transition, what you end up with is not assertive and confident young women who want to go off and be astronauts. You get a few of those. But what you actually get is a lot of young girls who are devouring Twilight and Gossip Girl while their brothers are playing video games and searching the web for pornography.
So are those fictionalized accounts sort of today's substitution for rituals that we see in a lot of ancient cultures and even in Jewish culture, where you have the bar mitzvah and the bat mitzvah for children as they're sort of growing into those
rituals? This is the challenge of our era, I think. We don't want to go back to the bad old days. The bad old days were bad old days. We don't want to go back to the culture of 50 or 60 years ago. It was racist and sexist. We don't want to go back to that. So the challenge is, how do we create something new? What does it mean to be a woman in the modern era? And how is that different from what it means to be a man? It is different. The human experience differs depending on whether you happen to be a man or a woman. And we've had two decades of pretending that's not true.
Let me jump in.
The result is that we've got a lot of frantic girls and a lot of goofball boys.
Take a quick break. My guest is Dr. Leonard Sachs, family physician, psychologist, and author of the new book, Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is family physician and psychologist Dr. Leonard Sachs. His newest book is called Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls. Leonard, what forces are compelling young girls to express and even fabricate sexual identities for themselves before they're naturally ready to experience these things?
Yeah, that's such an important point that I talk about a lot in the book. So mom was telling me how she wanted to get a T-shirt for her six-year-old daughter, and she went to Kmart and Walmart and JCPenney's, and she couldn't find one. All she could find was camis, camisoles that start right above the nipple and come down to right above the belly button, and that's not what she was looking for. This is up north, and it was cold. So she finally went to the boys' department and got a Black Ninja T-shirt for her six-year-old daughter. Why is this happening? And, of course, I'm not putting any weight on that particular anecdote. There's lots of scholarship. For example, I cite a monograph by the American Psychological Association, 108 pages, and dozens of authors, showing that our culture now sexualizes 7- and 8-year-old girls in ways that really would have been unimaginable just 20 years ago. 20 years ago, magazines like Teen Vogue and Cosmo Girl did not exist. But today, basically, a great majority of the 11- and 12-year-old girls are looking at those magazines that are focused on how you look in a midriff top and how important it is to have a skinny tummy. And so I commonly now encounter 7- and 8-year-old girls who are convinced they're fat and have to go on a diet. Now, 20 years ago, you would often find teenage girls who had those concerns. But we are robbing young girls of girlhood, that era that psychologists call middle childhood, roughly 6 to 11 years of age, that era of Harriet the Spy and Pippi Longstocking, has been eradicated. You basically go straight from Barney the Dinosaur to Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan in our culture. And it is really harmful and toxic for these young girls.
Well, you know, the clothing example is interesting. I was buying school uniforms for my 9-year-old this week, and I was looking at the online reviews and the copy for one of the little uniform blouses, not the ad copy for the people trying to sell this thing, but, you know, the moms reviewing it said, oh, this is a really flattering, slimming cut. And I'm thinking, I can't imagine that mattering for an 8- or a 9-year-old. But are parents buying into this as much as their daughters are?
Well, some parents are trying to resist. So, you know, mom was telling me about Halloween. You know, I remember when I was 9 years old and we had Halloween dress-up day at school, and girls would dress up as a bunch of grapes or a witch in a long black dress. And this mom's telling me that they went to, it was either Kmart or Walmart, and the daughter insisted that she, this 9-year-old girl, she insisted that she had to get the Pussycat Dolls outfit, which is a mini skirt with fishnet pantyhose, stiletto heels, and a brassiere top. And mom said, which is sold in a size suitable for a 9-year-old girl, which itself is pretty remarkable. I mean, imagine going into Sears 30 years ago and saying to the clerk, I would like to buy a Halloween costume for my 9-year-old daughter that consists of a mini skirt, fishnet pantyhose, and stiletto heels and a brassiere top. They probably would have called the police.
Yeah.
You know, you would have been seen as a pervert. But today, that has become standard. And this, and mom said, well, you know, I don't think that's such a good idea. And her daughter said, what is wrong with you? All the girls are doing that. That's what all the cool girls are wearing. You're going to, like, totally ruin my whole life. And mom is uncertain. And again, one of the motivations I had for writing the book is to empower that parent, to say to the parent, this is why this is so harmful. Because a lot of parents aren't sure. They think, well, you know, I guess it's modern or liberated or whatever. Let kids choose. And parents need to understand, why is that so harmful, and why you need to be the parent. And you need to say, I'm sorry, that's not happening.
Another change you've been struck by is the growing number of adolescent girls who identify as lesbian or bisexual, according to some surveys, 1 in 6. And I want to stress here that you are not saying it is necessarily a bad thing to have more lesbian and bisexual women in the world.
That's why people are so terrified to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you ask the question, and 1 in 6 is actually the low end, there are other studies that say as much as 24%, which is nearly 1 in 4 young women identify as lesbian, bisexual, or leaning in that direction. or preferring a female sexual partner over a male sexual partner among young women. And very little discussion on this. I wrote a post on this for Psychology Today that got over 600,000 hits, which is a lot, because this is a topic people are interested in, but very few people are willing to talk about in a frank and a scholarly way, because the moment you raise the question, in the eyes of many, you are saying there's something wrong about being lesbian or bisexual.
That is not the point you're making.
It's not the point I'm making, because figuring out who you are in terms of sexual orientation is one of the main and most basic tasks of becoming an adult. And for girls, it's always been more problematic and more complicated than for boys. Men who are homosexual, with few exceptions, will tell you that at 12, 13 years of age, they knew. They may not have wanted to admit it to themselves or to others, but they knew that they were gay. And they try their hardest, many of these men, they think, if I just find the right girl, I can be straight, and it doesn't work. They're stuck. But this is not true for girls and women, and I've had a lot of scholarship on this point, and as well as my own experience with these girls and young women. This girl thinks she's straight, believes she's straight, has been in satisfying romantic relationships with a boy, and then she discovers that she's not, that she can have a deeper and more meaningful connection with a woman. That the boys are, I mean, it is common nowadays, common in this country for a 15-year-old to demand, a 15-year-old boy to demand that the girl give him anal sex, which would have been very unusual 20 years ago. It is common today. And it is also common for a teenage boy to ask or demand that his girlfriend shave her pubic hair so that she more closely resembles the porn stars that he has all over his computer. And at some point it occurs to some of these girls, you know, I'm interested in more than physical intimacy. I'd like some emotional connection. I'd like some spiritual connection. But this goofball who's obsessed with pornography doesn't seem capable of that. But you know what? Emily, my best friend, is. And not true of all girls, not true of most girls, but a growing proportion of girls are finding emotional and spiritual and meaningful connection more easily with other women than with men. And this is has changed pretty profoundly. As I said, 20 years ago, it would have been almost unthinkable for a teenage boy to demand anal sex of his girlfriend. Today, it's common. And that's one part of why this is happening. But again, what's frustrating is that very few people are even asking the question, why has the proportion of girls who identify as lesbian and bisexual exploded in the last two decades? Very few people are even asking the question because the question is not politically correct.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go first to Blake in Dallas. Hello, Blake.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Dr. Sachs, thank you for being on the show. I read Gender Matters when I had very small girls many years ago, and it was a very impactful parenting book, and I recommend it to everyone. And my wife is actually currently reading your new book. My wife and I have largely opted out of dominant culture with regard to the norms of our society today, with regard to, you know, sexualizing our children and all these other things. And I wanted you maybe to comment on the costs that people like me, that we, when we opt out of dominant culture, that our kids pay. our children, you know, get accused of living under a rock because they don't watch TV for 6 hours a day, and because I don't let my 8, 9, and 10-year-old have Facebook accounts and things like that. And there's a price to pay that I think many parents don't either have the human cap or the psychological.
I think we're losing the connection there, Blake, but I think we have the substance of your question. Do you want to respond
to
that?
I think he makes a real good question, because especially with regard to social networking like Facebook and YouTube, when I speak to parents, as I did two nights ago in Charlotte, North Carolina, that's one of the big topics we address. When is it appropriate for your daughter to have a Facebook page? And what should your involvement be as a parent? Should you be your daughter's Facebook friend? Should you know what's going on there? What about YouTube, which a lot of kids are now using in a social networking way? And a lot of parents are really clueless on this point. You know, we all try as parents to be just right. We don't want to be too hard. We don't want to be too soft. And in the real world of deciding about sleepovers and privileges, I think most of us do the best we can. But in the digital world, a lot of parents don't know what to do. And so without intending it, they become the permissive parent. They are completely unaware of what's going on with their daughter's Facebook page. And this is harmful. We're just getting this new research, which I cite in Girls on the Air, Girls on the Edge, showing the more time a girl spends on Facebook and the more Facebook friends she has, the more likely she is subsequently to become anxious and depressed. Facebook seems to push girls to become more anxious and depressed, and we're starting to understand why that is so. Facebook promotes a positive spin. Girls post things on Facebook that are good things. Look at my cute puppy. Isn't it cute? Look at these cookies I baked. Look at this cool party I was at. When the puppy dies a month later, it turns out girls don't post that. And the result is you've got this 13-year-old girl looking at all of her friends' Facebook pages, and it's like, wow, look at all this fun stuff they're doing. My life sucks. They don't realize that the girls are only putting up a little slice of their life, just as she is. But 13, 14, 15-year-olds don't have that insight. Now, the caller mentioned the Facebook page for kids under 10. Well, of course, Facebook itself says that no one's supposed to use this if you're under 13. But as the caller implies accurately, there's a lot of kids under 13 on Facebook. But the point I'm trying to make in the book is that even for a lot of parents think, okay, she's 13 now, she can have a Facebook page and I don't need to supervise it. No. Facebook is toxic for girls, and they don't understand why. And parents need to know this. Parents need to be involved. Does that mean, as the caller suggested, you need to absolutely prohibit it? No, I don't think so. I know a number of parents like the caller who do, and without exception, those parents have no regrets. They're glad that they've prohibited Facebook. But that's a very tough stance to take when more than 80% of American girls now have a Facebook page, 13 to 17 years of age, that is. So what I say instead is, okay, allow it, but offer guidelines. Make limits. There are programs like WedRoot and Cyber Patrol that allow you to lock out Facebook on your daughter's computer after half an hour or 45 minutes. Because what we have now is a lot of girls who are on Facebook at 2 in the morning. And a lot of boys who are firing photon torpedoes at the enemy at 2 in the morning. Yeah. The same issues that I describe with video games and boys apply with Facebook for girls.
We have an email here from a sixth grade teacher and mother of two teenage girls who says, I'd like to hear Dr. Sachs address what teachers and schools can do to help address these concerns, especially when it seems so many parents are fueling the anxieties.
Well, that's a good point there, and there are so many things that teachers can and should do, and I'll actually be in Dallas August 9th and 10th to lead a two-day workshop sponsored by the Dallas Independent School District to really work with teachers on what you need to know about this new era. But one real simple thing is texting. The Nielsen Company latest data from 60,000 actual cell phone users across the United States found the average teenage girl now sends or receives 4,050 text messages in 1 month's time. That works out to 135 texts every day. That's one every 7 minutes of every waking hour, including school days. So what's going on in school today is a lot of girls are bringing their cell phone into the classroom. Many schools have policies prohibiting this. Those policies are rarely enforced. And this girl thinks she can multitask. She's making eye contact with the teacher and smiling and nodding at the teacher while she is at the same time texting with the phone underneath her desk. So I say to the teachers, make sure you can see the hands. Make sure you can see the hands. Enforce this policy that you probably already have at your school about no cell phones, and explain and educate your parents, because the people who push back when the principal tries to enforce the school policy of no cell phones being used in the classroom is mom. Mom says, well, I have to know where my daughter is. There might be an emergency. And you explain to mom, okay, if there's an emergency, you are welcome to call the school office and we will pull your daughter out of class. But no, we're not going to allow your daughter to be texting you during class, nor you, should you be texting her during class to ask what she wants for supper. That can wait. If we're going to take education seriously, then students need to have one focus in the classroom, and that is learning, not texting their friend about the party tonight.
Well, the phone issue is so ironic because I think, you know, all of us who have purchased phones for our kids do it for reasons of safety. No one says, I do this so that my child can be, you know, hooked up to his or her friends 18 hours a day. And yet the safety component, the communicating with parents component becomes like 0.1%.
Yes.
And then the rest of it is often, yeah, not always, but often
18 hours a day. But what's really troubling is that it's actually more like 24 hours a day. So your daughter is going to bed with her cell phone, and at 1 in the morning, she's getting a text from her friend about what happened at the party last night, and your daughter's up for an hour in the middle of the night exchanging texts with her friend. You don't know this is happening because she's not talking, and the phone never rang. It just buzzed. But the principle of good parenting hasn't changed. Kids should not be up in the middle of the night exchanging gossip with friends. So I've got a very simple recommendation for parents. The cell phone charger stays in your bedroom. The parents' bedroom. At 9 o'clock each night, the phone is switched off and goes in the charger in your bedroom. Your daughter can retrieve it the next morning. She won't like this. She'll say, but what if there's an emergency? You say, fine, we still have a landline. If there's an emergency, your friend can call the house phone, and I will pick up, your father, and I'll decide if this emergency warrants waking up at 2 in the morning. It probably doesn't. But parents have to step up and do this. You cannot expect your daughter to do this. What is she supposed to say when her friend says the next morning, hey, I texted you last night at midnight. How come you didn't answer? You expect your daughter to say, oh, I thought it was more important for me to get a good night's sleep? No. Let your daughter say, my evil witch of a mom takes my phone every night and puts it in her bedroom till the next morning. And I say to parents, you've got to be willing to be the evil witch or wizard so that your daughter can get a good night's sleep.
Dr. Leonard Sachs is with us. He's a family physician and psychologist. His new book is called Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is family physician and psychologist Dr. Leonard Sachs. His new book is called Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls. We should stress to people, Leonard, that this is not a hopeless book. You have lots of concrete ideas for parents, one of which is the importance of nurturing a young girl's or young woman's spirituality, whether that's in a secular sense or whether your family has a faith tradition to fall back on.
Yeah, and you know, that's where parents really jump on me. At one of these parents' presentations I did just a few days ago, a parent came up to me afterwards who had actually read the book, Father, and he said, you know, you're basically proselytizing here. You're trying to make converts to Christianity. And I said, well, that's not what I'm doing there. First of all, I'm Jewish. But more substantively, the point I'm trying to make there is that every human being has their own spiritual walk. Now, this father is an atheist and very proud of that, and he just assumed his daughter would follow in his footsteps, and he is horrified and stunned that his daughter wants to be an evangelical Christian, and this happens over and over again, and I relate a similar story in the book, and a lot of times these parents interpret this as teenage rebellion. The father who I describe in the book was convinced this was teenage rebellion because when he was a teenager, he was rebelling against his very religious parents, and now he's an atheist, so he figures his daughter's doing it all over again, but she's not. It's not rebellion. It certainly wasn't in that case. You need to respect your child's individuality. Now, every parent pays lip service to that, but when you're an atheist and your daughter wants to attend an evangelical Christian congregation, that's when we find out if you really believe it. And a lot of parents don't. A lot of parents resent and misunderstand what's going on here. And it's so important because if a girl does not have a spiritual center, she's going to search for something to put there. And if it's not spirituality, it often becomes sexuality. In our modern culture, sex is kind of the idol that many girls put in that place. And it puts them in a very dangerous and vulnerable position because it gives authority to their boyfriend that no human being should have. And I describe some stories of really horrible outcomes because I'm trying to make the point that if you care about your daughter's welfare, it has to be more than just feeding her and taking her to a good school. It has to be nurturing her spiritual center. And that's certainly the most controversial chapter in the book. It was the hardest to write. I was very fortunate to find Rabbi Sandy Eisenberg Sasso, who gave me wonderful guidance in writing that chapter, because her congregation in Indianapolis is a Reform congregation. Most of the people there are not religious. Very few believe in the truth of the Bible, say, but she's their rabbi. So how do you do that? How do you be a religious leader in a community, in a congregation that is not religious? That's the challenge that she faces, and that's what I was trying to do in that chapter. How do you allow your daughter to go her way, to find what works for her spiritually, even if it's not what works for you?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now. Rhonda in Murphy is on the line. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to give a testimony in terms of the benefits of older women being involved, kind of like a surrogate parent in young women's lives. I spent earlier this week speaking to three women who ironically were all teachers, not directly my teachers, but neighbor teachers, to tell them, thank you for being that woman in my life, in my formative years, that allowed me an opportunity to be a girl, to be a young lady, to be a young woman, and then a wife and a mother without all of the stresses that were going on in my life. They did not overly emphasize the sexual aspect of, let's say, a 15- or 16-year-old girl's life. They just allowed me to be who I was becoming. So I wanted to take the time this week to go back and say to them, thank you, the oldest one being 96 years old. Mm-hmm. And as I spoke to each one of these three women, we just literally cried together over the 35 years that we've shared together. So I wanted to encourage other women who, let's say, are now in their place that could act as a surrogate woman to young girls that are coming up now, because I see that is a missing component. And I have a daughter myself. I see that is a missing component, that as a mother, sometimes you're too much at war with your daughter. So if there's another woman who shares your values that can come up alongside you and can kind of act as a buffer between you and your daughter, that allows each of you all to have your space and allows you to grow, but in particular allows that young woman, that young girl, to have someone else that they can share with without saying, you know, my mom is always the mean mother in the group, because I've been the one that said it about my mother, and I know my daughter has said it about me, but there were those women that were that buffer that allows me, and I hopefully will allow my daughter to say, you know, what she was saying had my best interest in mind, and did not allow me to, let's say, become one of the wild girls that you see, whether or not it's on MTV or whatever. So
Rhonda,
I just wanted to give a shout-out to those women.
A community of women for girls is something that we used to have in this country, and that's well documented. We no longer do, particularly among English-speaking girls. We've lost that. 30 years ago, it would not have been unusual for a 15-year-old girl to go shopping with a woman 30, 40, 50 years of age, who was not her mother. Today, that 15-year-old girl is going to the mall with other 15-year-old girls. She doesn't want her mother with her. And that's a really profound change. We have broken the bonds across generations. And those strong bonds across generations, which used to be a feature of our culture, we used to have lots of opportunities for women and girls to hang out together, whether it was a quilting circle or bowling clubs, 50 years ago, I'm talking now, they're all gone. And one of the points that I make, especially in the closing chapter, is that we need to recreate them, and I give examples of women who are recreating them. It could be a backcountry canoeing trip, as it was for a community in Minneapolis, where 3 days, three nights, you've got an all-female canoeing trip going down the St. Croix River, and so this girl is in a canoe for 3 hours with a woman who's not her mother, and then they disembark, and then she gets on the canoe with another woman. That's the kind of opportunity we need. You look at what happens in most churches today. What is the church youth group? it's ninth grade boys and ninth grade girls getting together for a pizza party. That is not what ninth graders need. The church could easily create, and some churches have created, a women's group that includes girls, women of all different ages, 12 to 80 or 90, getting together. And I give examples of how that's worked. What girls need is not what girls are getting. And one of the key points I make in that final chapter is that what girls need in religious terms and spiritual terms is very different from what boys need. This is not my opinion. There's a lot of good scholarly work demonstrating this fact. Most pastors don't know of it. Most church members don't know of it. The church youth group has to be reinvented. It should not be ninth graders getting together for a pizza party. It should be a community of women for girls and a community of men for boys.
Let's go back to the phones now. 800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Eleanor in Fort Worth. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi. I was going to say that I think when what he said about Twilight was spot on, that it's really gotten into something where it's just about girls wanting to be the princess who's rescued by the prince. They don't really do anything in there.
Well, thank you very much for your call. We'll go back to the phones, take some more calls now. This time we'll go to Ellis County and speak with Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hey. Hi. Say, I just wanted to say that I think that men and women and boys and girls all have kind of the same need, and that's the need to feel good about themselves. And for a boy to feel good, he may feel masterful if he is able to conquer a video game, and a girl may feel desirable and feel good about herself. But it all stems from the same motivation. We all want to feel good about ourselves.
Well, sure, but I think that's a bit trivial, don't you? I mean, what, as you just pointed out, what boys need to feel good, what boys want, is different from what girls want. There's a lot of boys who really enjoy firing photon torpedoes at the enemy. The average boy in the United States spends 2.5 hours online with Call of Duty. Among those playing Call of Duty online, 2.5 hours online, 2.51 to be exact. Girls are playing Farmville. They're spending 20 minutes online. So what makes boys happy is different from what makes girls happy. There are very few girls who are obsessed with Call of Duty, Black Ops, or with Grand Theft Auto, Vice City. And it's important for parents to understand why that is so. It's not trivial. It's quite profound. So to say, yeah, everybody likes to be happy is true, but it's meaningless. What's useful for parents is to understand that what your son wants is different from what your daughter wants. And that's why you got the older son who's a goofball playing video games and the younger daughter who's anxious and obsessed and cutting herself with razor blades.
So, Leonard, what do you recommend to parents who maybe identify with a lot of what we've been talking about today and aren't sure whether they're in a position to make a positive change for their daughters and, for that matter, their sons, or whether they might need some professional help to get this done?
Well, that's a very good question, because a lot of parents are turning to psychiatric resources and medication. And I am convinced that those medications are overprescribed, and that a lot of kids who are on these medications need something else instead. They're troubled, for sure, but the solution sometimes is to help this girl find her spiritual center rather than to put her on Luvox or Celexa or Adderall. And that's where I'm really impatient with the psychiatric community, particularly because they have sold out quite literally. The leadership, people like Dr. Joseph Biederman at Harvard Medical School and Dr. Nemiroff at Emory, these are chair people of departments of psychiatry at medical school who now admit that they have taken $1 million, $1.6 million, $2 million from drug companies that they never publicly disclosed. And Dr. Biederman's hosting conferences at Harvard Medical School without mentioning the fact that he's actually getting a lot more money from the drug companies than he is from Harvard. And so even the physicians often are not aware of the downside and the risks of these medications, because the leadership is functioning as a paid sales force for the drug companies.
What's the proper balance for parents to strike with their daughters in terms of respecting their right to privacy and their need, in fact, to make some mistakes that they will ultimately learn from, and the need to check up on them and ensure that they're not in serious trouble?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question, and I think it's a question that most parents err on the side of giving too much leeway. So, for example, I speak to parents and I say, look, we now live in a culture where sexting is cool. Rihanna said, if you don't take naked pictures of yourself and send them to your boyfriend, then I feel sorry for your boyfriend, end quote. So what is your 14-year-old daughter supposed to do when her friend says, hey, how about I take pictures of you taking your clothes off and you take pictures of me taking my clothes off and we'll send them to our friends? What do you expect your daughter to say? She's supposed to say, that would offend my modesty. I mean, come on. This is not the era of Audrey Hepburn. This is the era of Lady Gaga and Beyonce. There's a difference. So what do I recommend to parents? I say, you've got to install this software on your phone, and I have no commercial connection with these people who make the software, but you put this software on your phone so that any photo your daughter takes with her cell phone goes immediately to your cell and to your laptop. And so when her friend says, hey, how about you take a picture of me taking my clothes off, she can say, well, I can't, because the moment I take the picture, my mom is going to see it. And I actually learned about this last year from a girl who was in this situation and did exactly that, said, I can't take the picture because my mom will see the photo immediately. And her friend said, wow, I wish my mom cared about me that much. Girls are more modest than you realize, but you have to lay down the guidelines. You cannot expect 14-year-old girls to lay down to mentor themselves. That's why they have parents. But the parents are clueless. The parents have no idea what's going on with the cell phones and the Facebook and the YouTube. And that's why, again, that was a big motivation for writing the book, is to say to parents, you need to step up. So one parent said to me at one of these presentations, she said, you're saying I shouldn't trust my daughter? I said, you're darn right. That's exactly what I'm saying. So because I was saying you must have an adult home to chaperone when kids come over to your house. Because you got a bunch of 15-year-olds in your house, there's no adult there. One of the boys is going to say, hey, your parents have vodka. We can pour it out and drink it, put water in the bottle. They'll never know. Again, what is your daughter supposed to say? Oh, that wouldn't be right. You need to have a parent present. You need to be the parent. If you don't, if you step back, you're putting your daughter at risk.
Dr. Leonard Sachs is a family physician and psychologist. His newest book is called Girls on the Edge, The Four Factors Driving the New Crisis for Girls. We will put a link up to Leonard's appearance coming up in August on our think page of KERA.org. Leonard, it's been a real pleasure, obviously touched a nerve with a lot of parents. I really appreciate you spending this time with us.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.